I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is January 17th, 2023. Time is flying by. Let's see. We do have a quorum. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of January 12th, 2023?
So moved.
All right. Representative Pinky moves the minutes of January 12th, 2023. Any discussion to the minutes?
All right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Let's see. We got some late breaking news that we got to switch the agenda around a little bit today, but we're still going to get stuff done. We got Representative Jordan here.
Hey, everyone.
So I will move. So if you remember, members, we discussed and took testimony on House File 34 last week. There were a couple things that we wanted to make sure we had correct before we move the bill out of this committee, and so we laid it over. So we've got House File 34, so I will move House File 34 back in front of us, and this is going to be recommended to be placed on the General Register after we take care of this amendment. So Representative Jordan, it's the A1 amendment to the DE1 amendment. I will move to reconsider adoption of the DE1. Representative Jordan, do you want to explain what we're amending here?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members, and thank you for the discussion last week. Because of that discussion, we have a better bill in front of us. And so when we researched the idea of retroactivity, and by we, I do mean Mr. Hopkins, we found that under Section 13, what matters is the classification of data at the time of a data request, not the classification of the data when it was collected. So all data previously collected will be subject to the bill's new provisions and the DE's changes to that data classification don't need to explicitly address retroactivity. But we did make a change, and it was based off of feedback from nonpartisan staff and Minkoji. We are making the bill effective immediately instead of waiting for it to take effect over the summer. So that's the big change from last week. That's the amendment, and I ask for your support.
All right. Any discussion to the amendment, as we already discussed the whole bill? Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson? Oh, okay. Oh, you're scratching your ear. Okay. There we go. We're in real life now, so that kind of looks like you're trying to get on the list. So
just made a bid if we were having an auction.
Right? Yeah, don't take him there. All right. Any discussion to the amendment? All right. So I will move to adopt the A1 amendment to the DE1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Great. The motion prevails, and the amendment to the amendment is adopted. So now we've got the DE1 amendment as amended, so I'll renew my motion to adopt the DE1 amendment as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Right. Now we've got that amendment adopted. Let's see. Now we're going to move on to the vote on the bill. Finally, that was fun. Lots of motions real quick here. That seemed like a lot of motions, but I think this is a great example of we had a discussion in committee out here in the public. We got some feedback. We found a way to make the bill better, and we're still able to move this bill forward today. So with that, we're going to move on to the vote. I renew my motion that House File 34, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and now you get to go to the General Register. May you finally get this bill done, Representative Jordan. So, members, initially we were supposed to have the Department of Administration here to present on Chapter 13. I know you were all really excited to get up early for that purpose. We got word right before committee started that Ms. Moxley-Goldsmith, who usually presents on this, is unable to be here today. So we're trying to see if there's a recording of it. It's pretty standard thing that we've given in other years, but I do think it's important, especially for new members, that they get that background, and for current member, people who've been here longer, that we get that update and reminder, a refresher. So stay tuned. We may still have some kind of presentation for you by the end of the committee, but we're just going to move right ahead to the bills. Ready, Representative Feist?
Thank you.
All right. So we've got House File 56 we're going to do first. So Representative Feist, would you like to move House File 56 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right. So we've got the bill in front of us. Representative Feist, please tell us about House File 56.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was brought to me by the Minnesota County Recorders Association, which is comprised of all 87 of Minnesota's county recorder offices. County recorders are tasked with maintaining complete and accurate records of documents pertaining to the conveyance and encumbrance of land within the county. This legislation proposes technical changes and tweaks to reflect advances in technology and update real property recording statutes to modern accepted practices. These provisions were originally brought to the legislature in 2020 and reintroduced late in 2022 legislative session. Progress has been delayed by fluky procedural hiccups, and this is the year for this common sense good governance bill. Here with me today to briefly walk through the bill and answer any questions better than I could is Mary Schreiner. Ms. Schreiner is the Brown County Recorder and co-chair of the Minnesota County Recorders Association Legislative Committee.
All right. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Schreiner, and I am the recorder of Brown County. I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota County Recorders Association, of which I'm the co-chair of the Legislative Committee and the chair of the Housekeeping Subcommittee. I'm here to support House File 56. The goal of this bill is to update and modernize specific statutes and bring them in line with the practice and procedure of today's county office. The intent behind these updates is also to promote uniformity from county to county. MACRA, or Minnesota County Recorders Association, chose to address these statutes because they all, they're non-controversial and they affect the way we operate our offices. I ask that you support this bill as it will clarify and update the statutes and bring them in line with the county recorder's current practices and procedures. With that, I would like to thank the chair and members and for allowing me to testify today. I'll take any questions that you have.
All right. Thank you. Anyone from the public wishing to testify on the county recorder's update bill? All right. Not seeing anyone, we'll move on to member discussion. Members, any questions about this bill? Any discussion to the bill? All right. great job. And as always, great job to House Research. You know, if you're doing your homework, you should have all the basics already figured out by the time you come to committee. Any closing words, Representative Feist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a good governance bill, doing important things, and I hope for all of your support.
All right. With that, we will move on to the vote. Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 56 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to the general register. And thank you for coming to testify today. I know the roads weren't super, so. All right, Representative Feist, you get to stay put. All right, so now we've got House File 244 in front of us. House File 244, Representative Feist, would you like to be moved that that be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right, we got the bill in front of us. Please tell us about your bill.
Great. The Uniform Electronic Wills Act was approved by the Uniform Law Commission in 2019. Since then, it has been enacted in five states and territories: Colorado, North Dakota, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Utah, and Washington. This bill permits a testator to execute an electronic will and allows probate courts to give electronic wills legal effect. The testator's signature must be witnessed contemporaneously, but at the same time, either in person or remotely by use of electronic means. The goal of this bill is to modernize the law and solve interstate recognition problems where electronic wills are utilized. Note that, according to our experts today, this provision will not create any new opportunities for fraud in the execution of wills due to existing safeguards that will continue to apply and the availability of much easier forms of fraud for motivated bad actors. And my experts can answer any questions about that specifically. My testifiers today are the Uniform Law Commissioner, Michelle L. Timmons, and Cameron Kelly, co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Probate and Trust Section, Minnesota State Bar Association.
All right, we'll go on to your testifiers. Commissioner, if you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, my name is Michelle Timmons. Some of you may remember me from my position as reviser of statutes. It's hard to believe I've been retired 6 years already, but there it is. As you may also recall, I chose the Uniform Law Commission as my volunteer work in retirement. And so today I'm here in front of you as one of the Minnesota Law Commissioners. For the past 20-plus years or so, the Uniform Law Commission has drafted and approved a lot of acts that involve the impact of the digital revolution and what the impact that it has had on our society and the law. So as early as the year 2000, for example, Minnesota enacted the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act that made electronic methods approved electronic methods in most business transactions. Then the Uniform Legal Material Act followed in 2013. Then in 2018, you may recall that Minnesota enacted the revised Uniform Law on Notarial Acts, which, among other things, provided a secure procedure for notarization by a remote online notary. The next Uniform Act to incorporate electronic procedures is the one before you today, the Uniform Electronic Wills Act. The Minnesota Uniform Law Commissioners and the Minnesota Bar Association worked collaboratively to tailor the Uniform Act to Minnesota law. House File 244 is in the form drafted by the Probate and Trust Section of the MSBA and has been approved by the MSBA Legislative Committee. The Uniform Law Commission has also reviewed the bill and agreed that it incorporates the Uniform Act. So with that background about how the bill was developed to bring to you today, I'd like to turn the testimony over to Cameron Kelly, who is a co-chair of the Probate and Trust Sections Legislative Committee, to explain more about the bill.
All right, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Cameron Kelly, and I'm an attorney at Lohman Abdo. I'm also, as Michelle said, the section council member for the Probate and Trust Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association and the co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the section. We're really happy to be working with the Uniform Law Commission on this bill, and we think it is. We think it would make good law. Our section first began reviewing the Electronic Wills Act in 2019, and we renewed our interest in the act in the spring of 2020 when the COVID-19 pandemic was in full swing. At the time, there were tremendous difficulties in getting a will signed, in large part because you would need to have four or five people in the same room for a traditional will signing. While the COVID-19 pandemic was one reason that our section took up the Electronic Wills Act when it did, the committee also discussed the act in the larger context of access to legal services. Rural Minnesotans have access to fewer attorneys and often need to drive greater distances to gain access to legal services. Other Minnesotans may be homebound, hospital-bound, or confined to a nursing home. This act has the potential to provide all Minnesotans with additional access options for estate planning. I want to shift quickly to the topic of fraud because I've heard that there are some questions on that issue today. This was one of the primary concerns of our section as we began reviewing the act. By incorporating the act directly into the Minnesota Probate Court, we hope to ensure that Minnesota's current case law on execution, validity, and the probate of wills will apply to electronically signed wills. This includes the probate code's requirements for competency, signatures, undue influence, witnesses, and self-proved wills. Generally, a will can be signed by a competent adult and witnessed by two witnesses. A will can be made self-proved by including a self-proving affidavit in the will, which, if included, must be notarized. These same requirements would apply to electronic wills. If an electronic will is self-proved, it will be notarized in accordance with the newly adopted revised uniform law on notarial acts, which will require the testator and the witnesses to prove their identity to the notary through the use of valid identification, knowledge-based authentication questions, or both. The use of a self-proving affidavit is favored because it creates a strong presumption that the will is valid. Wills that are not self-proved are subject to a higher evidentiary standard at the time of the probate. The proponent of a will that is not self-proved will have the burden of proving that the will is valid, including presenting evidence such as the testimony of the subscribing witnesses in court. These witnesses will need to testify that they observed the signing or the attestation of the signature, that the testator was of age, competent, and that he signed the document, he or she signed the document, of their own free will. One final point. Recently, there's been a lot of conversation about the coming transfer of wealth from baby boomers. Much of this wealth is in 401ks, IRAs, and other retirement accounts. By one account, there is as much as $35 trillion in such accounts, and high net worth individuals have as much as 55% of their wealth in these accounts. The owners of these accounts do not pass these items by wills. Instead, they set their beneficiary designations, often electronically, by logging into their accounts online and by modifying the beneficiary. The point of this is to say that people who wish to commit fraud have an easier path by creating a will than creating a will and complying with the relatively onerous requirements of the Minnesota Probate Code. Those who attempt it will need to comply with the high evidentiary standard that is required in the probate of a will. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I think wills may be favored by murder mystery authors, but maybe not as common in real life. Any questions? I've got Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a threshold question. Remind us what self-proving means.
So, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A self-proved will is one that has a statement at the end that is essentially an affidavit. And the affidavit is signed by the testator, and it says, I am doing this of my own free will. And it's also signed by the witnesses who say that they observed this happening, that the testator is competent. And so the language for that affidavit is right in the Minnesota Probate Code already, the exact language to use. And in the end, what happens with that affidavit, like I think all affidavits, it's notarized. And that notary stamp has to be by someone who is registered with the state of Minnesota, complying with the Notarial Act, and they confirm that the people who are making those statements are actually the people that have signed the document.
Follow up, Representative Carroll.
So that hardly seems like it's self-proving. There's a whole cast of characters who are present to what one witness the notary or witness the signature and all that stuff. So help me understand how this prevents fraud. That's my main concern is that electronically, are there ways to commit fraud or, in this case, to prevent it?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kelly.
Thank you. So I think that the idea behind it, and it may be a misnomer, self-proving, is to create that redundancy where you have multiple people making a check of the fact that this is someone who, A, actually intends this to be their will. And, you know, so attorneys have formalities that they follow when they go through the signing process. We're all around the table. We say certain things about, do you intend this to be your will? And, you know, the witnesses are observing the competency and the age and things like that of the testator. And then it's being notarized. And that notary essentially is to validate the fact that the identity of the people who are signing the document. And it's not to say that if it's self-proved, it couldn't be challenged later, too. It still could. But the bar for challenging it, the burden of proof would then shift to the challenger. So if I've self-proved that will, then I've met the basic threshold for admitting the will to probate. Now, if another sibling believes that there was undue influence or something like that, they can come in and challenge it. That standard's been kind of the time-honored standard of paper wills for a very, very long time. And now, if this were passed, it would be the same standard for the electronic wills.
All right. Follow-up, Representative Carroll.
And, Chair, so it seems as though it's just, as the information we've been giving, it's just bringing this to the modern age in terms of electronic means. It doesn't change anything that you wouldn't do in paper. So it's like a electronic court record, for example. It just mimics what's on paper. Is that correct?
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you. I would agree with that. It's changing the medium that we're using, but not the process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Chair Vector Finn, Representative Feist, thank you for bringing this. I do have some concerns on this. One of the biggest ways of fraud is through electronic means. So I have some current concerns on that. I'm not sure if all the safeguards are in place. But I was wondering if the person is using a lawyer online going through this, does that lawyer have to be licensed in Minnesota? Or could be they'd be sitting in Canada or Ukraine doing this over the line? Is there a way to provide structure to make sure that the lawyers that are helping these people do these electronic wills are actually licensed in Minnesota?
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the same rules for unauthorized practice of law would apply to a will that was drafted by an attorney. So if an attorney was drafting a paper will and that attorney was seated in Iowa and not licensed in the state of Minnesota, they would have to look at the rules of professional responsibility to determine whether they're able to draft a will in the state of Minnesota or not. And I can't tell you exactly what those rules would say, but the same rule that would apply to the paper will would apply to the electronic will. We're not giving permission by doing this for the person who is drafting the will to be in Canada, for example, and unlicensed.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn of the testifiers. That's one of the concerns I have because you cannot tell where they are. I get stuff on my emails and stuff continuously, spam phone calls for this stuff that you have no clue where they are. In fact, some of the spoofing of phone numbers where they calling you, the way they can do electronic stuff now is I get a phone call and I have a special ring when my wife calls. I looked at my phone. It was my wife's phone number that's calling. It was a telemarketer spoofing my numbers. So I have concerns about doing this electronically. I know how important wills are. This past year, I had to deal with my parents' estate. And thankfully, they had a will and all the documentation that we did not have to go to probate to deal with stuff. And so it's important that we do have wills and they're done out properly and make sure there's no things in place so they can be challenged. Because I've seen in my career in law enforcement, there's not a better way to destroy a family than dealing with the estate. So I want to make sure that when we go through this, if we go through this and do this, all the precautions are in place, and not just say they are, but let's actually write it down to make sure they're in place.
And one thing I'll point members to, if you go to line 5.13 of the bill and look at the definition of presence, it does require that you can see and hear the testator. So I don't think you could sort of like be a bot pretending to be somebody unless you had a way to, you'd have to have some kind of sci-fi technology, I think, to fake that. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for this question. As a licensed attorney, I would say that, you know, we have a lot of ethical rules and restraints on our representation. This bill really doesn't change those at all. It's more about where is the testator and allowing certain electronic wills. But the attorney rule, ethical rules, remain identical and aren't implicated at all, if I'm correct.
Further follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, members, I don't have an issue with the lawyers doing it because they are the vast majority are ethical. It's the scammers that pretend to be lawyers and that stuff that I'm concerned about.
Got it. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the benefits of this for sure and the efforts to eliminate the risk of coercion and undue influence. I do think we have to be careful not to minimize the difference between physical signing where someone is in the presence of a testator and has an entire room view versus the limited perception that anyone has dealing with somebody on a screen. And so that's my main concern. Anything you can say to help allay that concern, I think, would be helpful. I think it's probably on balance more the benefits outweigh the risks, but I do think we have to be realistic about and clear-eyed about the risks of, you know, someone else being in the room with the testator that changes the calculus when it comes to undue influence or something like that. Those possibilities, I think, open up with electronic signing of a remote testator from the other witnesses that are there, including the notary. So any response you can give to that or way you can allay those concerns would be helpful.
Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Niska. I will just answer briefly, and then I'll let the experts talk. But I would say the fact that this has been implemented successfully in five other states, and there, to my knowledge, have not been any of these issues or challenges to those electronic wills, I think is a good sign that's not an issue. But I will let the experts answer even better than I can.
Commissioner Timmons.
Madam Chair and members, I think there are really two points here. One is the point that the chair already made that in the definition of presence, we're saying either the individual has to be in the same physical location as the testator, or if they're remote, they have to be able to see them as if they were in the physical location right by the testator. And that's on page 5. Then in terms of the signature, in terms of the notary for a self-proving will, we've already really dealt with that. A notarization would either have to be the old-fashioned kind where the notary is in the same spot as the testator, or they would have to follow the revised notarial act that we passed in 2018. And that has a very robust procedure. I mean, the remote notary has to register with the Secretary of State. They have to record the notarial act. So I think there are a lot of safeguards, and the fact that you have a lot of the safeguards are already in the probate code, as Cameron testified, because you have the testator, you have to have a minimum of two witnesses. And then if you want to have a good chance of avoiding probate, you want to use the self-proving will option, which adds another layer of protection, and that's the notarial act.
Follow-up, Representative Niska.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify one comment you made about recording the notarial act. If it's being done remotely, does that create some sort of obligation or suggestion that the notary should actually save the video of that
Commissioner Timmons.
Madam Chair and members, the law requires that those videos be saved for, I don't remember the period of time off the top of my head right now, but it does require that those be saved so that if they're needed in court at a later point.
Thank you.
All right. I realize I forgot to ask if there were any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill. All right. Not seeing anyone. Representative Feist, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would encourage the committee to support this bill. The Uniform Law Commission is a great resource, very deliberative, collaborative body that comes to the legislature with really good advice for technical updates to our laws. So I hope to have your support. Thank you.
All right. With that, Representative Feist renews her motion that House File 244 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
All right. The motion prevails, and House File 244 is on its way to the general register. With that, I'm going to pass the gavel.
Get my junk out of the way.
Chair moves that House File 321 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Chair Beckerfan, would you like to discuss your bill?
Yes, that is my motion, and we'll talk about House File 321. I was hoping we would have the Chapter 13 updates and overview before we got to this bill, but that's all right. We're gonna dig into Chapter 13 together. So House File 321, this is a bill that I've brought for the last couple years, and we did discuss in the Data Practices Commission, and for members who've been on this committee before, this is very similar to what's been before us in the past. So essentially, I'm just going to start at the beginning with what the law currently is around educational data. So in Chapter 13, in Statute 13.32, has to do with educational data. And right now, there is something that's called directory information that is information about students. And we're talking about kids, so kids in public, elementary, middle, high school. And right now, the default in our law is that this directory information is public information. And this directory information includes a child's name, home address, phone number, grade. For student athletes, it can even include their height and weight, as well as other contact information for that child. And I dug a little bit into the research about this, and so this is now the second biennium bringing this around. And you know, the original idea with directory information, it seems like it was set up in FERPA, which is the federal law that oversees this. You know, I'm sure in 1950. It probably seemed nice, you know, when we had phone books where you could look up everybody's phone number and home address and, you know, be able to contact a family that way. But it's 2023. We live in a world where, unfortunately, especially people like us, you know, elected officials and other folks, you know, there may be threats against our families because of the work that we do. And, you know, whether you serve in lots of kinds of public service, that can be true. We also live in a world where once information is on the internet, it's really hard to get, it's impossible to get that information private again, because once it's posted online, it's posted online, as we've seen with folks. Doxing is a thing that did not exist, I think, when directory information was originally conceived of. So right now, in many public schools in Minnesota, anyone legally could call up a school and ask for a child's home address without their parents knowing that that information has been requested. So what this bill does is it pulls in that information and makes the default so that that information is not public. If a student, like it's a student athlete who maybe is, seeking scholarships or, you know, some kind of, you know, college opportunities. There are still ways that all the other ways that it's already valid to share that information. We're not changing any of that in Chapter 13.32. And you could always tell the school that you're fine with them sharing that information. But what we're doing here is reeling that in and making it so that that private contact information about a child would not be publicly available. One thing I do want to make clear, too, is that schools can opt to have more stringent policies, and some of them do. So I know, for example, the public school my children attend has a more stringent policy where the default is not to share this information about their students. For members, if you've ever tried to send out graduation letters to graduating seniors, you may be aware that, you know, some high schools won't give you that information, and some high schools will willingly give you that, you know, that document with that child's name and address. And it might be, we might like it in, you know, we know we're not using it for nefarious purposes, but it should be troubling to us that a child's home address could be readily available to anyone who asks for it. So this, that's what this bill does, is it reels in, it further defines directory information, and makes it clear that private contact information in particular. So a child's name would still be available, so you could still do yearbooks, but you wouldn't be able to call and get that child's home phone number or home address. So that's mostly what it does. You know, and we've had discussion from various different people over the years, so there is... we did change a little bit, making it clear there was a program in St. Paul where they were helping kids sign up for library cards through the public library, which we added some language as compromise language to try to make folks less worried that that program would be impacted. And due to that, Representative Scott and I had a conversation on Friday, and Representative Scott had a suggestion for an amendment. And so, Chair, if it's okay with you, I would be okay with Representative Scott going ahead with that amendment.
Representative Scott, please, your amendment.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment. And basically, as you can see in the underlying language, it just limits the purposes to the sharing of this information to just issue a library card to the student. And I would love to have members' support.
Chair Breckerfin.
Yeah, and I'm supportive of the amendment. You know, as I said, that language was added as sort of comfort language. And if we want to rein that in further, that's fine with me. So I would be supportive of the A1 amendment.
To the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Before we move on, I would like to ask if there's anyone in the public that would like to testify. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Rich Neumeister.
Proceed.
Members of the committee, for the record, I would like to thank Representative Becker Finn for, again, the discussion of this. I just want to make a couple things that I think are important for more of information to band on a little bit. FERPA is the one, and it's a finite set of data called directory information. FERPA, the federal law, tells the school boards, you decide what you want as directory information to be generally public. So the school boards makes the decision. That's why, for example, as Representative Becker Finn indicated, in her school district, it is limited. Now, what this bill does, it takes away the ability for the school district or the school board to designate certain elements of the data, which is the contact info. And so then, basically, the state is making the decision, school district or school board, you will be able to designate certain finite data, but these data elements are always going to be basically private, except for then when you look on the language that was just amended, and I don't know how it reads now, when you take a look at lines 321 through 325. Now, the concern I had was lines 23 through 25. My impression, based on the amendment that has been deleted. So my concerns that I would articulate even more are no longer there. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the few moments of your time, and thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any member discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beckfin, I have a question. If my kid, I have a 7-year-old, and every once in a while I get a statement from her saying, today my best friend is so-and-so, and it changes more often than I can keep track of, and she's like, can you arrange with her parents to say, hey, can we have a play date somewhere? I'm like, who is she again? Because it changes. I know that my school has the information to be able to reach out to, has a list. This is the student. This is their parents. As a parent, then, if my school district wants to say, you know, at the beginning of the school year, check this box saying it's okay to share within this very small group, is that still okay with this legislation?
Representative Beckerfin.
Your school district could have a policy that allows parents to opt in to sharing that information. I know my kids are also in elementary school, and I know very familiar with the, hey, mom, can you text? So can you add so-and-so to my Roblox account? You know, very, very familiar with that. So one thing, I know most teachers, at least in the years my kids have been in school, are happy to facilitate that connection of parents that way. I know I've even sent a post-it note with my cell phone number on it with my kid to school so that, you know, Jace's mom can text me if Jace wants to line something up. But yeah, you could still opt in. I mean, you can still, on your own accord, choose to share that information, but that would be your choice instead of the school board potentially saying, nah, we're cool with everybody having your home phone number.
Representative Friedrich, any follow-up?
I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other member discussion? Chair Beckerfin, would you like to close?
Yeah, thank you. And one thing I didn't bring up that is also, and it's hard, I could not figure out how common this is, but and they didn't want to testify because they were kind of embarrassed about it. But another thing that can happen with this information being public is that I had a friend of our family, someone we knew, who the high school senior was, you know, an okay athlete, and was contacted by a for-profit college in another state who was able to get their home contact information through their school and essentially tried to trick this student into thinking they were being scouted. And, you know, if you think of a 17-year-old who's, you know, maybe life dream is to be scouted to play sports at a college, you know, this is a way that folks with, you know, that want to seek that information. And here was a college that was going to cost $60,000 a year with a mediocre scholarship. And it was that was the only way they could figure out how they had gotten this family's home address and phone number, you know, because it was a cell phone number. It's not like it was listed directory information anywhere, and it was even listed under, you know, it was with their carrier, it's under the parents, you know, it was so it was really troubling. And so that's another thing that can happen, just another example of you know, as we talk about fraud and people scammers, you know, that's another thing that the current law does not protect our kids from, and this would make that information more private. So with that, would appreciate member support. I've been working on this for a couple of years to get it right, and I do think it's a better bill with tightening up that language with the Scott Amendment. So appreciate the discussion and us making the law better. So with that, would just appreciate member support.
Thank you, Representative Beckerfin. With that, I renew my motion that House File 321, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. You're on your way.
All right. Representative Hewitt, you made it. We knew Representative Hewitt had another committee to be in. So Representative Hewitt, I will move House File 227 be recommended to be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. And then, Representative Hewitt, would you like to move the amendment right away?
Yes, if I could, Madam.
All right. So we'll move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hewitt, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks once again for hearing it in my lifetime at the legislature. We've tried this 3 times. So hopefully the 3rd time is going to be with some success. The amendment adds on legislators as part of the individual. Actually, this, again, like many of you have heard in the past, this is not a well-lobbied bill. There is no humongous lobby of notary publics that want to do marriages. It's just a matter of it just makes the most sense that they would have the credentialing to do so. And move forward. And then a number of legislators have come to me and say, well, is it possible that we could put, and both sides of the aisle, actually, I've heard this from, is it possible that we could actually put us in there? And then research did a really good job of digging into this and finding what other states do. So this kind of follows in line with the way other states are doing it. Our laws in Minnesota are kind of, when they speak to this, are very weird to say the best. I mean, and one of the, this is a very personal to me if you haven't heard the story. Before I was a legislator, I was actually headed to be a deacon in the Catholic Church. I had a family member come to me and say, can you do our marriage for us? And I said, I really can't, but let me see what I can do. And what I was able to do is go online real quick, fill out a form to the Church of the Stars, and basically I was set for ordination in that church, and I could go down to the county and get my credentialing to become a marriage officiant. That's all it takes in Minnesota, right there. Lo and behold, what I found out when I did that, because he really wanted me to do the ceremony, I just took my chances out to becoming a deacon in the Catholic Church because I just profound my ministry to a Church of the Stars. So that upsets me. And for that reason alone, I cannot understand the letter we got from my beloved church about why they want they're opposed to this. It makes no sense because we do have a lot of people out there that can already perform these ceremonies under the Church of the Stars. This actually puts some credentialing to it. You can still do that. I'm not taking any of that away, but it gives some criteria to what we look at as far as being a marriage officiant and having some sort of credentialing to your name. So that's where I came up with this. I don't want to take too much of the committee's time, but stand for questions, Madam Chair.
All right. Any members of the public wishing to testify on House File 227? All right, not seeing anyone. Now we can move on to member discussion. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hewitt. So had you been a notary, would that have interfered with your ability to become a deacon?
Representative Hewitt.
I don't believe so. That's a great question, Madam Chair. I can get back to you on that, but that wasn't one of the, no.
And Chair.
Representative Carroll.
So I was initially concerned about this, this legislation. Now having heard you and read about it, I think I'm generally supportive, but I am just kind of concerned about some of these other little ties that need to be wrapped up. So if you can get back, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, we have another stop, so I'd be happy to meet with representative to see what we can do about that before our last stop.
Because I wouldn't like...
Representative Carroll.
I'm sorry. So I wouldn't like... I would like you not to be... not have the ability to be a deacon and have this interfere.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, I think that decision is already left.
Okay.
The building.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, well, and for the public and for newer members, members of the legislature are notaries by default. It's a slightly different than someone who actually goes through the process to be a notary. But so that's partially where that comes up. Any other discussion to the bill? Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. And I just would like to follow up quickly because that sounds like a question for the Catholic Church, not for the legislature to answer. So I would hope that we would not concern ourselves with the answer to that question in terms of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Vigier. But I believe you're correct on that, although we can all have some empathy for Representative Hewitt's situation. I also got ordained
online. If you have $39.95, you can be ordained, and then you can perform marriages, which, you know, with how important that is, you know, it does the standard to become a notary is actually harder than it was to get ordained online. Any more discussion to the bill? All right. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Hoyt. I'm just wondering what you brought up makes start thinking. Instead of doing notaries, why not tighten the thing so some of these outside groups that are coming in online, not who knows, they could be in what country doing the ordaining to give you the certificate. Why not tighten up the process to be able to perform the services?
Representative Johnson, you could draft a bill. I will say, too, I can tell you personally that the process is that after you go online, you do have to go to your county recorder's office and you do have to file information there. That was actually much harder than paying for the thing online. But for the response, Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I feel for you there. I think this is a way to get the first part done because I have had requests of people saying, what can I do about this and stuff like that. So one step at a time, but I would welcome, I would be happy to co-author a bill with you to try to clean up some of that because I could start my own internet business and do the same thing of my own church, but then I'd get thrown out again. So I'm just waiting for when you get excommunicated, you get a Bible and a candle, I guess, and I check the mail every day. So.
Representative Hewitt, any closing comments?
No, Madam Chair, and thanks for hearing it again. I appreciate the members, and I appreciate the discussion. And as this goes forward, I look to working with any of you that are interested in this. Thank you. I'm still looking for co-authors in the House, the Senate filled. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 227, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
All right. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to state and local government. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. And members, as I said, we aren't going to have the presentation from the Department of Administration. However, they did send us the overview packet, and I'm not going to, like, keep you here to read it out loud to you. This is not how I roll. But I would really, we're going to adjourn early. With the time that you have, I would highly recommend that you take some time to read that and see if you have any questions. And as I've mentioned before, you know, when we have the bills in front of us, it doesn't give you the entire statute. It just sort of gives you, it doesn't give you the whole chapter of statute, which is good as far as wasting paper. But, you know, take some time and go look at chapter 13, online and look at the scope of it and everything that's there. You know, we joke about it as being sort of, boring, nerdy stuff, but it's very important. And, if you are one of those members who gets it, that can really be an asset, to this body to understand chapter 13. So, you don't need to be an attorney. You just need to have some diligence, in figuring it out. So with that, that's sort of your homework. You can choose whether to be a good student or not. That will be on you. Before we wrap up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for encouraging members to take a look at that. You can also, many members don't know this, but you can also order your individual just Chapter 13 book. And it's just a joy to have that at your fingertips. and this stuff is, you know, when I was first elected, this stuff seemed to be a whole lot more nerdy than it is now because in this digital age and the ease of which people can share information, especially government entities between one agency and the other, it has become increasingly more interesting to a lot of people. So, encourage members to look at that and, wow, if there's any way we could actually get them back in here, if there's any time to squeeze them in, I think it'd be beneficial. But are you going to check to make sure they did their homework? Or?
I'll know based on your questions or lack of questions. But I know, too, that we will – so Anna will send out an email with – you know, a digital version of what was handed out, as well as a link to the presentation, video of the presentation from previous years. I just don't know that I'm going to have time with all the work we're trying to get done. If there's a way to squeeze it in, we will. But, you know, I was trying to get it in earlier in the session, and, you know, that's life. People get sick and things happen. But, yeah, I will. There won't be a quiz, but I think I'll be able, I think Representative Scott and I will be able to tell. So with that, members, any other questions? All right. Enjoy the 35 minutes I'm giving you back. We are adjourned.